San Francisco, Bay Area, I am coming for you November 21st at 6 p.m. I will be at Book Passage at their Ferry Building store in San Francisco doing a reading of my new book, Now Is the Way, doing a signing, taking pictures with you, talking to you about various things, this and that. I'm really excited to come do that, and I've had a lot of you all reach out from the Bay Area and ask for me to come there, so here I am, or there I will be. So come hang out at the Book Passage Ferry Building store on November 21st at 6 p.m. Hey, my friends, what's going on? Welcome to the Astro Hustle. I am Corey Allen. Hope that you're doing all right today. Hope that all of the elements that create your mind and your consciousness are aligned and connected in such a way that they are generating an arising of self-awareness and awareness that is flowing through the world, that is attuned to the world and to itself. And the self I'm talking about is you, your agency, your consciousness, in such a way in which you perceive it to be pleasurable. And that is a fun way to say, I hope that you're doing good, hope that you're having a good day and feeling good, all of those type of things. Welcome to the show. My guest is Philip Goff. He is a leading philosopher of the mind, has a new book out called Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. And essentially, he puts forward a beautiful argument for panpsychism. And I know that the collection of atoms that create your brain and generate your consciousness will definitely feel some good brain stretches from this one. My friends, I'm very happy to tell you that this podcast is brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of amazing classes covering dozens of creative and entrepreneurial skills. You can take classes in everything from photography, creative writing, design, productivity, and so forth. Skillshare is a really great idea, a great company in that they provide all these different types of classes and things that you can learn from, you know, illustration to graphic design, photography, even audio editing, art, music production, marketing, productivity, really anything you can imagine, they have a class for it. And to me, one of the most important things about continuing to grow, continuing to evolve, and also not getting locked into this comfort zone of one way of seeing the world, to me, always learning and learning how to do new things is really crucial to growth. And not only does it make you see the world in a different way, but it also just broadens your toolkit for whenever you want to go do something in life. So Skillshare makes it easy for you to hop onto their website, go out, check out a class when it's convenient for you. And a really cool thing about it that I like is that you can submit it to their online communities and get feedback on what it is that you're working on. And that's a really great way to just kind of get extra eyes and extra perspectives on the work that you're doing as you're trying to grow and develop and learn a new skill. So for my sweet, dear Astral Hustle listeners, you can go join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today and get 2 months of Skillshare for absolutely free. That's right, Skillshare is offering the Astro Hustle listeners 2 months of unlimited access to thousands of classes. So to sign up, go over to skillshare.com/astral. Once again, that is skillshare.com/astral, and you can start your free 2 months right now. skillshare.com/astral. All right, my friends, the time is now. Let's do it. Let's lock in. And let's go talk to the great Philip Goff. I don't know. To me, just as an outsider over the last couple of years even, it seems that panpsychism has increased its view in the public. I just see more things about it, more articles about it, more writing about it has come out. I see more people talking about it. And, you know, it's a term that's, I guess, like 4 decades old. Can you just define and lay out a basic description of what panpsychism is?
Sure. You know, so I guess on our ordinary scientific way of thinking about things, consciousness exists only in the brains of highly evolved organisms, and so consciousness exists only in a tiny part of the universe, and only in very recent history, cosmically speaking, and, you know, relative to the whole history of the universe. Whereas for panpsychist, consciousness pervades the universe and is as fundamental as mass and charge. So yeah, so that's it's the ancient view, I guess, that consciousness is a fundamental and ubiquitous feature of the physical world.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty challenging one for people to generally square in their minds, because it raises a lot of questions, of course. Like, people think, well, if there's a fundamental element of consciousness in all elements that create the physical universe, then, you know, where does that stop and how does it scale? Because you think of, like, all right, of course, the hard problem in consciousness is, like, we've got the same matter and other things that is put together, and it does not seem to have awareness or consciousness.
Yeah.
But yet when those are put together in the shape of the human brain, then all of a sudden, ta-da, there's sentience. But then you can, yeah, you know, that way of thinking opens a lot of potential kind of woo-woo type of thoughts. It opens, yeah, a lot of thoughts that really just pull the floor out of the old ideas about consciousness. What are your kind of intuitions around that? What does it lead you towards?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. I mean, I think panpsychism's gone from being sort of laughed at insofar as it was thought about at all, to being taken, you know, very seriously as probably still a minority position, but certainly in academic philosophy, it's become a position that's taken very seriously. I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons for this, and part of it is the rediscovery of some really important work from the 1920s by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the scientist Arthur Eddington, who was incidentally the first scientist to experimentally confirm Einstein's general theory of relativity after the First World War. So I mean, I'm inclined to think these guys did for the science of consciousness in the 1920s what Darwin did in the 19th century for the science of life. And it's a kind of tragedy of history that for various historical reasons, like the Great Depression and the Second World War, it got forgotten about for so long. But it's recently been rediscovered in academic philosophy and, you know, is causing a great deal of excitement and a lot of publications. So their basic starting point of Russell and Eddington was that physical science doesn't really tell us what matter is. And, you know, that's a kind of bizarre thought at first. You know, you read a physics textbook, it seems to be telling you all this incredible stuff about the nature of space and time and matter. But what Russell and Eddington realized is that physical science, you know, despite its richness, is confined to telling us about the behavior of matter, about what it does. So, you know, physics tells us that, for example, that matter has mass and charge. And these properties are completely defined in terms of behavior, right? Charge is about attraction and repulsion. Mass is defined in terms of gravitational attraction and resistance to acceleration. This is just all about behavior. Physics tells us nothing about what philosophers like to call the intrinsic nature of matter, how matter is in and of itself, independent of its behavior. So it turns out there's actually this huge hole in our scientific story of the universe. And basically, the proposal of Russell and Eddington is to put consciousness in that hole, right? We've got this huge problem that you've already referred to of, you know, how does consciousness fit into our scientific worldview? You know, on the one hand, consciousness is the thing that's most familiar. Nothing is more evident than the reality of your feelings and experiences. But there's this problem of how on earth it fits into our scientific worldview. Where's the place of consciousness? Russell and Eddington saying, look, there's this huge hole in our scientific story. So the idea is, let's try and put consciousness in the hole. So so the resulting view is a kind of panpsychism. But it, you know, it needn't have any connections to, you know, older forms of panpsychism. You know, the basic idea is there's just matter, nothing, not necessarily anything spiritual or supernatural. There's just matter, particles and fields, but matter can be described from two perspectives. Physics describes it, as it were, from the outside. It tells us what it does. But matter from the inside, that is to say, in terms of its intrinsic nature, is constituted of forms of consciousness. So it's this beautifully simple, elegant way of integrating consciousness into our scientific worldview. And that's why it's, you know, people are really starting to think, you know, this could be a real way forward on this most difficult of issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that the subtitle of your book, the book is Galileo's Error, but then the subtitle is Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. And Even I think you could take that chunk you just described, and that is a wonderful expansion on that subtitle, because it seems that, yes, there are all these different fields of science, but one of the interesting things is that they need, as you mentioned, they seem to need a bridge to to each other to begin to understand the fundamentals of consciousness and some of those questions you mentioned. But one of the inherent issues that I think that science has, it seems, and also just humans have as general, is that, like, looking at the world in a particular way and then becoming relatively biased to their own system of seeing things and their own way of thinking about things. So you can look at that through just a subjective perceptual lens of, you're saying, oh, well, I see the world this way and this person sees the world that way. Well, they're wrong, I'm right, whatever. Not taking into account any perceptual things happening there. And then also in science, you know, people get really into their particular discipline. As you mentioned, like, physicists would only kind of, because of so much rigid training in a certain way of thinking, they only can tend to see the world in that way. And if it doesn't work in that way, then it's sort of irrelevant or hard to understand. But it seems that, like, we're in this point in human society right now, human existence, like, as a species, where there's a lot of challenges still going on with our species, but for the most part in the Western world, people have solved the physical problem of our species. Like, we have food, we've got water, there's shelter, there's order, there's civility in general, you know, like, we kind of have that worked out to a degree. And I think now our great battle is the battle of our minds, of reality, of, like, that's the next frontier, is to now, I think, begin getting a handle on our brains and our consciousness the same way that we've got a handle on our on the physical aspects of our being. How do you see all those branches being able to work together nicely and what have you going forward?
Yeah, I think that's right. So, I mean, I think we're currently going through a phase of history that will be looked back on as a phase of history where people are so blown away by the success of physical science, you know, and, you know, the incredible technology that's resulted from it, that it leads people to say, oh, that's everything, right? This is a complete story. You know, and that leads to a nice sense of, you know, certainty and security. Like, you know, we know where the truth lies. You know, people say about, you know, religion being a sort of crutch that, you know, gives people a sense of certainty. But, you know, I think the same can be true of a certain materialistic worldview. You know, you feel like this really works. You know, people like Daniel Dennett, I think, you know, it becomes like a sort of religious commitment. But, you know, what I try to press in the book, you know, which is the reason for the book's title, is that, you know, I think the reason science has gone so well, precisely because it was designed for a very specific focused task. And Galileo was very explicit about this, right? So, you know, Galileo, you know, is the father of modern science, has very much shaped the philosophical foundations of the scientific revolution. You know, and a key moment there was Galileo's declaration that mathematics is to be the language of the new science. This new science is to have a purely quantitative vocabulary. But Galileo completely understood that you cannot capture consciousness in these terms, because consciousness is an essentially qualitative phenomenon, just in the sense that it involves qualities. You know, if you think about the redness of a red experience, or the smell of coffee, or the taste of mint, you know, you can't capture these kind of qualities in a purely quantitative language like mathematics. So Galileo said, right, what we've got to do is take consciousness outside of the domain of science, and after we've done that, you know, we can capture everything else in mathematics. So Galileo, in this way, you know, kicks off mathematical physics, which has gone incredibly well, but it's got, you know, we've sort of forgotten that it was never intended as a complete account of reality, right? The whole project was premised on putting consciousness outside of the domain of science. So, you know, I think this is absolutely crucial because, you know, it's broadly agreed now that that consciousness does pose this profound challenge to contemporary science. You know, despite our great progress in understanding the brain, we still don't have even the beginnings of an explanation of how, you know, complex electrochemical signaling could somehow give rise to the inner subjective world of colors and sounds and smells that each of us knows in our own case. But I think, even though the problem is taken very seriously, a very common response is to say, okay, well, we just need to carry on with our, you know, do a bit more neuroscience, carry on with our standard methods of investigating the brain, and we'll crack it. And I think the reason people think this is because they look at the great success, as you say, you know, physical science in, you know, explaining more and more of our universe and producing incredible technology. And they think this should give us confidence that it'll one day crack the mystery of consciousness. But the irony is, it's done so well precisely because it was designed to exclude consciousness. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and Galileo understood this. If he time traveled to the present day and heard about this hard problem explaining consciousness in the terms of physical science, he'd say, you know, of course you can't do that. I designed physical science to deal with the quantitative, not the qualitative, you know? So what I'm trying to bring us back to is, you know, the philosophical underpinnings of the scientific revolution and the philosophical underpinnings that remain behind our scientific approach to this day. And I think we've got so carried away that we've kind of forgotten that there is a philosophy behind our current approach, and it was never designed to deal with consciousness.
So what do you think that consciousness is? And I know that's a super broad question and it's the thing that's trying to be discovered, but yeah. Do you have a general sense about consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, consciousness is, you know, it's paradoxically, it's the thing that's hard to define precisely because it's so familiar. You know, if you ask what consciousness is, I'd say, you know, you are currently having an auditory experience of my voice speaking to you, you know, a visual experience of the world around you. Perhaps you're feeling a bit tired and bored. Perhaps you're having some tactile experiences of the chair beneath you. So this is all part of your consciousness, all part of what it's like to be you right now. So people often say that there's a mystery of what consciousness is. I actually think that's maybe not quite the right way to put it. You know, I think we all know what consciousness is. You know, nothing is more familiar and obvious than one's own feelings and experiences. I think rather the mystery is how consciousness fits in with our scientific story of the world. So we've got this objective, quantitative, mathematical story from physics. We've got this qualitative, subjective reality that we know from our own consciousness. They seem so different, and yet they must belong to the same world. And so that's the challenge, really. You know, how do they meld together? You know, historically, there's been two approaches, you know, to get rid of one of them. You know, that the materialist wants to get rid of the consciousness bit and just keep the brain. The other extreme, the idealist, wants to just keep consciousness and forget the brain. But I think what panpsychism offers us is a way of bringing them both together in a single, unified picture of reality. In the 1620s, Galileo separated out consciousness in the physical world. I think what panpsychism offers us is a way of bringing them back together.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine is a scientist, and he's doing a lot of experiments right now with stem cells, and essentially just taking, you know, different cells and then injecting them with stem cells and then watching those cells multiply and grow, and then studying, kind of dissecting and studying why each of these type of cells has the effect of stem cells and so on. And so he was telling me that he was doing some experiments with neurons and injecting those with stem cells, and that as they began to multiply and grow, that they actually all started twitching.
Uh-huh.
and moving. First off, that was the first time I've ever gone and stress eaten was after I heard about that. Because I just started thinking, you know, like, man, you know, speaking to panpsychism, if there's something about the neuron and that's multiplying and that starts moving, like, not suggesting that there was like self-awareness there, but I mean, it's moving, you know, and it's brain cells. It's a little freaky. How's that sit with you?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't heard of that. I'd really like to look into that a little bit more. What we're ultimately after is a kind of framework that's able to capture the scientific facts, however they turn out. You know, so I think neuroscientific data is absolutely crucial for a science of consciousness. I'm a huge fan of neuroscience, and I try to stay as up to date as I possibly can. But some people think we can just solve this problem by just doing more neuroscience. And I think, you know, one problem with that is what we ultimately get from neuroscience are correlations, right? You can scan someone's brain and you can ask them how they're feeling and what they're experiencing, and you can, you know, correlate the two. So you can discover that, you know, when someone has a certain kind of activity in a certain region of the brain, they say feel hunger. You know, these two things always go together. And that's, you know, absolutely crucial, and any theory of consciousness needs to respect that. But that in itself is not a theory of consciousness, right? Because, you know, what we ultimately want is to know why. You know, why is a certain activity in a certain region of the brain accompanied by a feeling of hunger? You know, why do they go together? And I think, you know, to do that, we really need to turn to philosophy. We really need to build a theory and try and work out which theory of consciousness best accounts for those correlations, you know. And there are, you know, there are different options. There's the, you know, the standard materialist option. There's the dualist option that someone like David Chalmers prefers. There's the panpsychist option. And, you know, all of these theories are empirically equivalent in the sense that, you know, you couldn't do an experiment to decide between them. And so we've got to look to other ways of evaluating theories. But at the end of the day, I think that the point is we need both the science and the philosophy to come together to really explain what's going on here. You know, you can't, all you get strictly speaking from the science are these correlations. That in itself isn't a theory. So I think, you know, what we're now seeing is we need both together really to make progress.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what does this do to your thinking of individual selfhood? You know, do you think of, you know, Philip as an emergent property of your body? And then once your body drops and melts back into the earth, where does Philip echo out into other waves in a panpsychic universe and then reemerge, not with the same identity, but with the same atomic energy or something? Or how do you see that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. So, I mean, so most of this book is the first four chapters of the five chapters in the book is just the sort of, you know, cold, hard scientific question, you know, and I think we should, when we're doing science or philosophy, you know, we should be thinking, I always want to emphasize this, you know, not what view we'd like to be true, but which view is most likely to be true. And I think there's a really good case for the probable truth of panpsychism on the basis that it's the best explanation of how consciousness fits into our overall theory of the world. But, you know, and this is what I do in the final chapter of the book, you know, it's still interesting to think about what implications these various theories have for human existence. And, you know, I think sometimes scientists and philosophers don't do that enough. And I'm inclined to think, you know, not only do we have good reason to take this view seriously, but it also is maybe a picture of the world that's a little bit better for our mental health and our spiritual well-being in some sense. You know, the standard materialist worldview is kind of pretty bleak. You know, there's there's kind of an essentially mechanistic picture of nature and then the cold immensity of empty space, you know. Whereas on the panpsychist view, we're conscious creatures in a conscious universe. You know, I think this is perhaps a picture of the world we can feel a little bit more at home in this universe, you know, a little bit more like we belong. Again, you know, that's not a reason to think it's true, but if you do think it's true, you know, it's interesting to think that it could be a slightly less disenchanted picture of nature. And another thing I explore is perhaps it could have positive effects on our relationship to the environment. You know, we're currently going through this environmental crisis, and you know, if you're a materialist and you think a tree is essentially a mechanism, then you're really going to conceive of the value of it indirectly in terms of what it can do for us, you know, either by looking pretty or more importantly sustaining our environment. But you know, if you think a tree is some kind of conscious organism, albeit a very alien one, then you know, the tree is a focus of immediate moral significance. You know, chopping down a tree is an act of immediate moral significance. So I think this has the potential to transform our relationship with nature, our relationship with the environment, in a way that's perhaps a little bit healthier. You know, like, we tend to laugh at people hugging trees or a lot of our, you know, and, you know, in a materialist worldview, hugging a tree is kind of ridiculous because you're hugging a mechanism. But, you know, if you were to grow up, you know, conceiving of a tree as a kind of conscious organism, then, you know, it looks a little bit less crazy to have a more sort of warm relationship to it. So, come back to actually the question you actually raised, thinking about what happens after we die. And, you know, I mean, in a way, a panpsychist needn't have a different view to a materialist, you know. And in some ways, the panpsychist view is very similar to the materialist view. The panpsychist says, you know, there's this mathematical structure to the world we get from physics. We agree with the materialist about that, but we just add something else, that it's infused with consciousness. So you could just think, when I die, you know, my brain, the consciousness of my brain ceases to be, just as the materialist does. You know, some consciousness will carry on, right? In some sense, the parts of the brain will still be conscious, but they won't have the kind of sophisticated, reflective kind of consciousness that we associate with a person, with a human being. But what I do explore in the book actually is whether, you know, if one independently had certain spiritual commitments, if, for example, you took mystical experiences seriously, then this panpsychist worldview might be more consonant. So I'm always keen to emphasize, you know, panpsychism needn't be essentially connected with any spiritual worldview. You know, most of the people defending it at the moment, like David Chalmers, for example, are just complete atheists, just trying to find a way to incorporate into our worldview the natural phenomenon of consciousness. But if for independent reasons you have certain spiritual worldviews, then perhaps a panpsychist worldview is more consonant with those. So for example, you know, in many traditions, in many different cultures, people have claimed to have experiences that there is some kind of universal unconditioned consciousness underlying all of reality, right? Now, if you're in a materialist worldview, you've got to think that's essentially kind of supernatural. You know, it's people might be reluctant to believe in something supernatural. They might want some evidence. But if you adopt this kind of panpsychist worldview and you were tempted to take these experiences seriously, then you don't have to think it's something supernatural. It could just be an aspect of the intrinsic nature of matter. So this is the thought that consciousness is part of the intrinsic nature of matter. If you did happen to think that there is this unconditioned consciousness underlying all things, you needn't think of that as supernatural. It could be just one aspect of the intrinsic nature of matter. Mm-hmm. So I guess the panpsychist view world does open up in a variety of ways, in a variety of possibilities, a picture of nature that's perhaps slightly more consonant with human happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think one of the things you raised about a tree having consciousness is a great thing to focus on for people who are brand new to the idea or struggle with the idea, or there's a lot of potential, as we talked about kind of towards the beginning, for taking panpsychism as something that it's not. So whenever you say that a tree has consciousness, albeit an alien one that perhaps is outside of the realm of human conception, could you expand a little bit more on that just to clarify?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, what I really go into in a lot of detail in my book, I mean, independently of the philosophical arguments I put forth in terms of for panpsychism, you know, we're now discovering, just in a straightforward empirical sense, how plants and trees are so much more intelligent and sophisticated than we'd previously realized. So there are experiments, for example, that we can subject pea plants to conditioned learning. So there's this classic experiment, Pavlov's dog, you know, from the 19th century, where we Pavlov famously conditioned a dog to associate dinner time with the ringing of a bell, right? Such that when the bell was rang, the dog started to salivate. So one kind of striking experiment to show this, they've managed to subject pea plants to conditioned learning. So this, you know, in a way that's reminiscent of the classic Pavlov's dog experiment. You know, Pavlov famously taught his dogs to associate the ringing of a bell with dinner time, right? Such that when he rang the bell, they started salivating, even if there was no food present. So the scientist Monica Gagliano, what she did was set up pea plants in a sort of Y-shaped tube that they could grow along. And now pea plants feed off a certain kind of blue light, so they tend to grow towards where the blue light is. And what she did was she had a sort of a humming of a fan, a sort of humming noise, always wherever the blue light was. And eventually, after she'd repeated this, she found that the pea plant grew where the noise was, even if there was no blue light. So they'd learned somehow to associate the sound of this humming with their food. So, you know, that's already pretty sophisticated. And some other striking work, how we've discovered how much, what a real living, sharing community the forest is under the ground. You know, we just see the bits of the trees above ground, but there's actually a real network of cooperation, even across species. So during the winter, the evergreen trees provide sustenance to the deciduous trees, and this is reciprocated in the summer period. So this, you know, human beings, you know, sometimes find it hard enough to reciprocate across cultural boundaries, but you know, across different species, we find this kind of incredible reciprocal activity. So I think, you know, I speculate a little bit in the book, you know, and this is just speculation, about what it would be like to be a child growing up conceiving of the world in panpsychist terms. You know, so if you're a child that grows up appreciating, as you're walking through a forest, that there's this buzzing network of community underneath the ground, you know, I think this really transforms how you think about nature in a very positive way.
I think 100%. Yeah. So this is an idea, or not really even an idea, but something that unfolded in my consciousness and decision-making that I definitely caught some shit for online after talking about it, but I think maybe you'll enjoy it. So I was a vegetarian for 7 years and then went to the rainforest about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, participated in some ayahuasca rituals with some shamans. And after that experience, my acute awareness of plant consciousness changed dramatically and very quickly. And it's, you know, not in the sense that the plant's, you know, talking to me or to us, but being in that environment, in that shifted state of consciousness, was immensely impactful in my awareness of exactly what you just described. And it actually made me start eating meat again. And that's the part where people generally don't like, but it's because, like, seeing, you know, excluding all things other than mammals from the picture of consciousness to me seems almost a little short-sighted on the human view. Now, of course, I understand that there's gradations of suffering and degrees of awareness, and that, you know, factory farming is terrible and all of that type of thing. 100% appreciate that, and it's important to me to think about. But after those experiences, after being a vegetarian for so long, looking at that, I thought, you know, actually, I think this whole thing is just one, and by the whole thing, I mean all the elements of in the material world, are just, it's just one waving, resonant blanket of being, and our human instinct to separate and, you know, carve off, like, okay, that's a human, and that's a cow, that's a tree, that's air molecules, that's radiation or whatever, is more about us and our way of organizing and our nervous system and our way of thinking about the world than it really is about how the world operates. And to me, for whatever reason, it made me just go, oh, it's all part of one giant churning system of life that is interconnected, and it's interconnected like that for a reason. And so I'm comfortable re-participating in that connection.
Yeah. So, well, I have to say, actually, I've been on a very similar line of thought to the one you've just described, really. That, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, that, you know, I think there are all sorts of reasons for being vegan or vegetarian, you know, to do with the environment, amongst other things. But I think a lot of people think, you know, plants are not conscious, animals are. So that's why it's okay to eat plants, but not okay to eat animals. So, you know, if you think plants aren't conscious, then you've got a nice, clear moral dividing line there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think plants are conscious. So it's hard to see where to draw the line. So, yeah, so I've been back and forth about, you know, what's going to be my ethical food policy. Just the last few weeks, actually, I've decided on a food policy. So what I've decided is not to eat red meat or dairy unless the calves are kept with the cows. So I think, you know, this is the thing that is not,
I like thinking of ordering in the restaurant with that one.
Yeah,
no, so no, have the cows at these steaks? I need to know where the calves kept.
Well, although maybe if more people asked that, it'd affect the market. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it effectively means, you know, I absolutely love cheese, but it effectively means, you know, milk, chocolate, and cheese become a sort of occasional treat from an ethical dairy. But, you know, I think this is the thing that's not focused on. You know, I've got a friend who's a farmer, actually, and his cows seem really happy. They're not dairy cows. They're really, really nice lives, except once a year they take all their kids off them, and they mourn terribly. You know, like 4 days. And, you know, his partner said, you know, she has to stay away. It's just horrific. So I think there is a real sophisticated emotional bond there that we quite routinely, you know, really mess with. So that's what bothers me, really, that sort of intense suffering, especially when it's intense emotional suffering. So, so I guess, as you say, we've got to find a way of just, you know, as you say, treating nature with respect and trying to minimize suffering and allow nature in all its aspects to flourish. But it's tricky. It's tricky. But the other thing you mentioned there, I mean, getting on to, I got a sense of more of a sort of, in some sense, a spiritual picture of the world where there's a kind of underlying oneness. And this brings, you know, back to the theme I was pushing before. I suppose for a long time now, there's been seen to be this conflict between a spiritual picture of the world and an essentially scientific picture of the world. But, you know, I think what this Russell Eddington-inspired form of panpsychism allows us to do is to bring these things together. You know, so we can say that this the more spiritual aspects to reality, perhaps this underlying oneness, is not something supernatural, is not something distinct from what the scientific story is telling us. It's just the intrinsic nature of that story, right? And in fact, I actually spell out in a fairly detailed way how you could think about that on one model, a view that's sometimes called supersubstantivalism. So this is the view that, you know, there's different ways of interpreting physics. Do we believe in particles? Do we believe in fields? Do we believe in both? One approach, this supersubstantivalism, is the view that fundamentally there's just space-time. And then what we think of as material objects are just mass instantiating regions of space-time. So the table in front of you is a table-shaped, mass-instantiating, massy, you know, mass-filled region of space-time. So material objects are identical with regions of space-time. So that's a kind of a reasonably popular, you know, sort of cold-blooded scientific way of understanding the philosophy of physics. But, you know, if you did think that, you know, there was this underlying oneness, this underlying universal consciousness, you could perhaps identify that with the intrinsic nature of space-time and identify more specific regions of more specific forms of consciousness with more specific properties like mass and charge and more complicated physical properties. So you know, this is instead of a way of avoiding this dualistic picture, you know, which I'm as opposed to as materialism. I think this picture of a divided world where we've got the consciousness and the spiritual on the one side and the material and the scientific on the other, of bringing them together to see that they're really just two aspects of the same universe. You know, and I think that's a really beautiful, elegant picture of reality.
I completely agree. You know, I'm so in America anyway, you know, integrative medicine is really becoming quite popular and really taking off, you know, people taking all different forms of medicines and, you know, and treatments and kind of, instead of being like, okay, here's Western medicine and these methods and here's these methods and what have you, really kind of putting all that together along with a lot of, you know, recently approved like ketamine therapies and psilocybin therapies and things like that for people with PTSDs and depressions and anxieties and just like, you know, looking at like, okay, let's see everything we got. Let's see how it can all help each other. And I think, you know, they found a lot of success with that. And I feel like, yeah, this is certainly the next step for philosophy and science as you describe, you know, and I mean, it seems clear, it seems plain to me that like, yeah, of course it's all a part of the same thing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the dualistic idea, of course, those are just two shades of the same thing going on. But as you described earlier, like in order to talk about them with clarity and intelligence, for whatever reason in the past up until now, you've had to like have this narrow point of view and only talk about one slice of that thing. And if you think about even further back in the past, people that have tried to marry science and religion get burned at the stake, like Bruno or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and science in at the start was essentially dualistic. So Galileo wasn't saying consciousness doesn't exist, only the physical world exists. Galileo said, he was a dualist. He said that they both exist, but consciousness is outside of the domain of science. I mean, he wasn't a dualist in the sort of Descartes sense that the soul being outside of the body. He had what he called the animated body, which he was more in Aristotle's conception of the soul as something essentially embodied. But he certainly thought it as something outside of the domain of science, something that couldn't be captured in a scientific way. So, you know, the book's called Galileo's Error, but, you know, I've got it. I think Galileo was amazing. And you know, maybe it was necessary what he did to have a period where we did carve things up, because it enabled us to spend the last 400 years or so, you know, really focusing in great detail on the on the quantitative properties on matter, of constructing mathematical models that enable us to predict with great accuracy how matter behaves. You know, that's such important information, because once you know in great detail how matter behaves, you know, you can manipulate the natural world in all sorts of extraordinary ways. So Galileo really, effectively what Galileo did at the start of the scientific revolution is say, you know, don't worry about consciousness for a bit. You know, just put it on one side. Mm-hmm. So we can just focus on the quantitative features of matter, what we can capture in mathematics. And it went really well. But, you know, at some point, I think people want a unified picture of the world. They want to see how it all hangs together. And I think, you know, now is the time to sort of bring things back together. Although, you know, people still haven't realized that. People are still in this mindset that, oh, this is just one more scientific problem. They've forgotten that, you know, our current approach was never intended for dealing with consciousness. But so I think what this gives us is a way of, useful as it's been to separate them out for a certain period of time, I think ultimately you want to bring everything back together. And so what I'm essentially calling for in the book is what I call a post-Galilean science, you know, a new, more expansive conception of science. It doesn't mean not doing physical science. It doesn't mean doing physical science any differently. You know, I'm not here to tell physicists how to do their job. They do a great job as it is. But it's realizing that's not the whole story, and it was never supposed to be. We need a more expansive conception of the scientific method, one able to accommodate both the quantitative properties of matter we've been dealing with so well for the last 400 years and the qualitative reality of consciousness that each of us knows from our immediate awareness of our feelings and experiences. Both of these are real, and so we have to find a way of accommodating them both, I think.
Beautiful. I love that. All right, Philip. Well, hey, it's been really awesome talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Galileo's Error, I read through the book, and I really enjoyed it. You did a great job setting everything up and going over the history and the background and everything to get to the new conversations that you're raising. And thank you for the work and everything. It's been a real pleasure, man.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks for inviting me. It's been really good chatting about this. It's made me think about it in a little bit of a different way, I think.
Beautiful.